Welcome to Global Minnesota Podcasts, connecting, informing, and engaging Minnesotans with the world and exploring important international issues. For a complete list of programs and to join us, visit globalminnesota.org.
Thank you for that introduction. I look forward to a good exchange with you tonight on this important topic. I've been connected to the Cuba issue for a long time. One of my first political memories as a 10th grader is living through the very difficult week of the crisis over the missiles and the possibility that there would be a nuclear war. But at the time, I knew very little about Cuba. So remember 1970, I was a graduate student at the University of Minnesota by that time and an activist against the war in Vietnam. And some of my friends went down to Cuba as part of an effort by the Cubans to harvest 10 million tons of sugarcane, and they sought volunteers from around the world to help them. And I remember being fascinated by the stories that they told upon their return from that time. I began to focus more definitively on Latin America in an academic way in the 1980s, after initially having my research and work in Spain. And that took me to Cuba in the summer of 1984 for language study and an opportunity to see Cuba hands-on for the first time. I've had approximately 15 visits back to the island since then. And it's been sometimes with students. Most recently, it was with alumni from my university. And I developed a very close collaborative relationship with Cuban academics, mainly from the University of Havana, with common interests in U.S.-Cuban relations and Cuba's relations with Latin America. Led me to being a part of a research group on Latin American issues. I just returned from for the 16th time with them in a meeting in Mexico just last week, where we talked about inter-American affairs. Led me to collaborate with Cuban scholars from the University of Havana on books both on U.S.-Cuban relations with my good friend Esteban Morales Dominguez, the director emeritus of the Center for the Study of the United States, and more recently with Carlos Oliva Campos, a historian, where we have done books on relations between Cuba and Latin America and the United States and Latin America. So that's just a little bit of my background. To understand how significant in many ways the U.S. policy change toward Cuba was in December of 2014, I think it's necessary for me to give a little bit of history, but I'm going to do a little shorter than I had planned, because I really want to get us into questions that you have tonight. So I'm only going to really go back tonight to 1959. And that helps to explain, I think, the importance of the decision by the Obama administration to change course on Cuba in 2014. Because that revolution, which happened as the result of dramatic events in Cuba between its launch in 1953 and the intense war that would take the lives of 20,000 Cubans between 1957 and 1959, it brought to power a revolutionary government on the 1st of January, 1959, under the leadership of the July 26 movement. Fidel Castro was a key figure, but there were others, Che Guevara, Camilo Cienfuegos, who led that. And they were, it was a revolution that was ending a period in Cuban history of 1902 to 1959, when Cuba, after its War of Independence, had in many ways become a protectorate of the United States. That era was a complex one. in the sense that, yes, it did through major U.S. investments in the island. It clearly improved the economic overall conditions of the island. A fairly significant middle class developed in Cuba's major cities. In 1940, they, as the result really of revolutionary events in 1934, they developed a very progressive and democratic constitution. But in the 50s, when a man who had been behind the scenes, and at one time the elected president of the country, Fulgencio Batista, created what became a very harsh dictatorship that spawned the July 26th movement. That's really what set in motion this revolution. And the United States, when the revolutionaries came to power, initially expected to continue to control Cuba. Their template for it had been a revolution 7 years earlier in Bolivia. A very powerful revolution that combined the efforts of miners and peasants to bring down an old oligarchy. But the United States was able, through diplomacy and economic aid, to really temper that revolution and to keep Bolivia, at that point, at a height of the Cold War, very much within the American sphere of influence. And the United States very much hoped and believed that it would be able to do the same in Cuba. It even sent the same ambassador, a man named Bonsall, to be there, to be the American diplomat that would oversee that. But it quickly became clear to anyone who, and I wasn't around, knowledgeable of it, but my reading of history, became clear that this was not going to be the case with Cuba, based on events that happened on the island and events and an event that happened in Washington. When Fidel Castro came to Washington in April of 59, not on a state visit, but a kind of private visit, invited by American newspaper editors, he did have a meeting with Vice President Richard Nixon. But what was most clear coming out of it, he did not request any assistance from the United States. And that's when the U.S. leaders knew that there was trouble brewing, because that meant that the United States would not necessarily be able to condition the help for Cuba and its involvement with it on an offer of United States aid, as it had done in the Bolivian case. But probably more important were the things that were going on the ground in Cuba, where it started to become clear that this was a very serious revolution and a very serious break with Cuba's past. The key signature action was land reform that nationalized all holdings on the island of 1,000 hectares or more. In the process, therefore, nationalizing the property of many U.S. Individuals and corporations that owned land there, and Cubans who had large plantations. The Cuban government also, as a move to solidify support from the urban population, froze all rents in their buildings and apartments in Havana, not allowing the owners of the buildings any longer to control how much the rents would be, and kept them at a place that was going to be affordable to working class Cubans. Also, the Cuban government moved very quickly against the people from the Batista government that did not flee the country. Batista himself did, but others did not. And a few hundred, somewhere 200 to 500 Batista loyalists, people that were likelihood responsible for the more than deaths of 20,000 Cubans in the period of 57 to 59, were very quickly put on trial and executed. And that was another signal that this was a serious revolution and that there was going to be a clear break with the Batista past. And then I'll just mention a fourth point, a willingness on the part of the Cuban leadership to open diplomatic relations with the Soviet Union, something which Batista's Cuba did not have. And they did that within a few months of taking power. Not beforehand. The Soviets had no involvement in or help in any way of the revolutionaries to take power. But once in power, the Cuban government began to reach out to them, I think well aware that the policies they were undertaking was going to get a sharp response from the United States. And just very briefly, I think most of you know, there was that sharp response from the United States. The United States began to cut off slowly but quick, but ultimately decisively, Cuba's ability to trade with the United States, mainly by eliminating the sugar quota that Cuba had for selling to the United States, and eventually a full embargo and boycott not allowing U.S. Citizens to either trade to Cuba or receive Cuban goods. Ultimately, the United States broke formal diplomatic relations with Cuba right at the final days of the Eisenhower administration in January of 1961. And we know and would learn a few years later, a series of assassination plots were hatched against Fidel in particular by the CIA, some done in failed cooperation with the mafia, U.S. mafia, which had its own issues with the Cuban Revolution because it had ended their ownership of very lucrative casinos and hotels in Havana. And then, of course, culminating in the invasion of Cuba in April of 1961 by exiles, by people who were connected to the old order in Cuba, who sought to go back and hope to overturn the revolution, and in a CIA-backed invasion at the Bay of Pigs on the southern coast of Cuba, but an attack which ultimately failed. So the hostility of the U.S. At that point underscored for Cuba especially and for the Soviets the need for them to move closer together. And I'm not going to go into that tonight, but that, you know, in part leads to the missile crisis, the October crisis of 1962. Over the next 50 years, from the early 60s, you know, mid-60s down to today, the two countries proceeded on very separate tracks. Very briefly, how I see Cuba. Cuba proceeded along the lines of constructing an egalitarian socialist revolution, one that most scholars would agree, in a sense, a country that was nationalized more of its economy ultimately than just about any other socialist country, even including after 1968, basically the totality of the services industry, down to your shops down on the local street corner, and moved to make a very narrow gap between the lowest paid worker and the highest paid technocrat, no more than probably 2.5 or 3 to 1, narrower than virtually any country on the planet. And they carried this out in the framework, beginning actually formally, but it was begun a bit earlier, within the framework of the socialist common market. The Eastern European countries and the Soviet Union primarily, which became 87% of their international commerce. Only tobacco, cigars, was really of a major product outside of that trade and was always a relatively small part of Cuba's economy. Within that frame, Cuba built a system, I think, again, most of the people in this room know, a system of health care, education, food security. They were building off, yes, a country that had more possibilities than some in 1959. They were building off a country that did have some things going for it, but they basically took that and made it available to the whole of the Cuban population. And it became a system admired and studied in a lot of ways, especially around the global South. Of course, they had to survive the fall of the Soviet Union and the collapse within a very short period of time in the fall of 1989, actually, before the Soviet Union fell, of the East European common market. They did so, not easily, but with considerable pain, by shifting to tourism and the provision of medical services around the world, and limited foreign direct investment, especially in the tourism industry. And like other countries, if you will, in Latin America, they formally in 1993 joined the economic game of remittances, which are huge for any Latin American country, roughly $30 billion a year for Mexico, for example. Well, Cuba legalized citizens to hold the dollar, and very quickly, hundreds of millions of dollars started flowing in from their relatives in the United States and Spain, and again, helping the country to survive this economic catastrophe of the loss of the Soviet Union. Today, probably close to $3 billion a year comes in remittances to Cuba. But I want to point out, for those who understand Latin America, any country in the Americas, especially the Caribbean Basin and Central America, this is very, very common. By the new century, Cuba was fully integrated, if you will, into most of the world's institutions and economy. And interestingly, it really was the isolation of the United States, not of Cuba. I always correct people when they say that Obama was bringing Cuba out of isolation with his decision in 2014. No, Cuba was not isolated. Cuba was fully engaged in the world with diplomatic relations with all the Latin American countries, most of the countries around the world. It receives tourists from around the world, its medical personnel around the world, its doctors in consultation with medical professionals around the world, including in the United States, by the way, including with ways that they were able to cooperate even with their professional counterparts in the United States. So Cuba was not isolated. It had become the United States that was isolated. So what did the United States do during this time? Basically, the policy of the United States remained largely unchanged, And that was that the United States, by whatever means necessary, short of invasion, which was really ruled out after conversations with the Soviets after the missile crisis, that there wasn't going to be an invasion while there were Soviet soldiers on the island, that this was not going to become the basis of starting a nuclear war with the United States. That was taken off the table, though at times it didn't seem that way, but probably in hindsight clearly was, but any other means of embargo and those assassination attempts, for example, and other ways to get a regime change in Havana. That was the largely unchanged policy of the United States. So what were the factors that led Obama in 2014 to shift? It really was the implementation of a strategy that I call engagement as a way to ultimately, still from the perspective of the policymakers in Washington, rightly or wrongly, to bring down the revolutionary government, but to do it through engagement. This was not new in this sense. It had first been implemented under the Carter administration in 1977, when, for example, U.S. tourism to the island was completely opened for several years, from 1977 to 1982. And then later, during the Clinton administration, through, among other things, the legalizing through Congress of agriculture and medical sales to Cuba, Cuba was engaged. And although those sales reached as high as $700 million at one point in the early 2000s. So this wasn't completely new, but the scale and scope of it was. Why was the scale and scope different when Obama moved to it in 2014 as the result of a year and a half or so of secret negotiations hosted in Canada and facilitated by the Vatican? One was the isolation that this policy was causing for U.S. policy in Latin America. There was a ticking time bomb of a small sort, but nonetheless it was there. And that was that President Obama had been at every 3 years is a summit of the Americas. The presidents of Latin America and the Caribbean come together with the U.S. president in the summit of the Americas, begun in 94 under Clinton. Obama went in 09 to Trinidad, in 12 to Colombia. And he got an earful at both summits about your Cuba policy makes no sense. But more importantly, in 12, they told him unanimously, there will be no summit in 2015. You can be there, but we will not if the Cuban president is not invited. So those of us who followed Cuba closely knew some decision was going to be needed unless the Latin Americans backed down or the U.S. maybe found a way to invite Raul there but not fundamentally change U.S. relations. And that would have been possible. I remember saying to my Latin American friends at the time that it's not impossible that he'd be invited to that meeting, but it'd just be a one-off, you know, and then he'd let, you know, in 2018 his successor deal with the next meeting. But yeah, there was that event. A second factor that I will argue was of significant import at the U.S. end was changing political perceptions in the Cuban-American community. By the time that Obama took office and by the time that he began to seriously consider a new policy toward Cuba in his second administration, the polling data from the Cuban American community in Florida was clearly undergoing a shift so that close to three quarters favored full diplomatic relations with the island and a majority favored the end of the embargo. Now, this did not mean that these Cuban Americans were now sympathetic to the Cuban Revolution or to Fidel, but on a pragmatic and political basis, they didn't see the continuation of what they saw as failed efforts to isolate the Cuban government had largely failed. On the political front, exit polling from the 2012 election showed that while the Republican candidate Romney still probably carried Cuban Americans, it was down to the low 50s compared to numbers up in the mid-70s that had been typical over many, many earlier years. So I'm sure in consultation with others in the Democratic Party, including Hillary Clinton, who would be the standard bearer in 2016, he was able to make the case that there will not be a political cost, even in Florida, for taking this stand. So that was a calculation that was there. Though it's always been my view that That was never the decisive factor in U.S. Hostility toward Cuba continuing. I had a chance in 2011 to, as part of a broad consultation that the Obama administration asked the Department of National Intelligence to do, I had the chance to go to a CIA building in Langley, Virginia, with another Cuba expert. With this, that day, we were simply asked, who's going to be the next ruler of Cuba, was the topic. And that others had come in on different subjects. Both Phil Peters and I said we couldn't name the person, but we could tell them that it was going to be a communist. And that that was the main thing they needed to know, was that there was not likely, in the, with the passing of the Castro brothers, to be a regime change from within, that it was likely to be a member of the Communist Party. But what struck me most that day was the nature of the people in front of me. There was only, out of the 30 intelligence officers there from many different branches and organizations, there was only one person I heard with a Hispanic surname. So Cuban Americans were not running this policy, and yet their questions, all of them quite combination of either hostile or sadly ignorant to myself and Phil, indicated that they felt just as negatively about Cuba and felt just as positively about our policy as did Cuban Americans in Miami. So it wasn't, so it was a more baked into the whole process. But I will give John McFarland, the head of DNI, credit. He said, as he introduced, you're going to hear some different views today. Please listen to them carefully. Please listen. And, well, eventually their boss, you know, did make a different decision. Whether, you know, those of us that consulted had any role, I will never know. A third piece happened on the island. And that was that Cuba, because of economic challenges on the island, began to open a serious private sector. Made a decision at the Party Congress in 2011 that up to 1 million Cubans, 20% of the population, needed to move into private employment by reprivatizing that services sector that had been statized some 45 years earlier, and create small businesses that would now employ them, independent of the government. And that created, I think, for those policymakers in Washington, a much greater sense that there were now more opportunities to really help build a private sector in Cuban life that they would hope, and still do, I think, over time, will become a political factor that can move Cuba maybe more closely to the United States internationally and move away from the socialist system that they live under. And from the perspective of policymakers in Washington, greater freedom understood as the freedom to do business. Why were the Cubans excited about the possibility of this change? They had long sought it. But it was limitations in the Cuban economy. The certain amount of running as far as you could go with the tourism expansion and the ups and downs of tourism, certain limitations even ultimately in the expansion of their medical services industry, that they needed better relations with the United States and therefore better relations with the international monetary system that would allow them to move their economy, forward. So that was the primary motivation from the Cuban side. They saw it as something that could help the Cuban economy, of course, from their perspective, still fully under the control of the Communist Party and of a socialist system, but that they could utilize that for their benefit. What has been accomplished? First of all, full diplomatic relations. Notice I did not say normal. Those of us who follow this say that there can never be, in all likelihood, normal relations between Cuba and the United States. The power asymmetry is simply too wide. But it's full diplomatic relations, though ironically, there's embassies now, but the American embassy in Havana is not headed by an ambassador because the Republicans in Congress have refused to accept the nomination of Jeffrey De Laurentiis, the man who heads that embassy, as an ambassador. But he's gone about his task and his work, as he told me when I met him in New York earlier this year. He goes about his business. I joked, I walked up to him and I said, "Ambassador," and with a big smile, because he knew why I was doing that. And he then said, "Well, of course, you know I'm not, but I hope to be." But that, at this point, has not come to pass. But this was very symbolically important. There had been diplomatic relations between the United States and Cuba of a formal character since 1977, and the buildings had been opened. It was a formality that they were not at the full level, and without it being a full level, that meant certain kinds of negotiations and exchanges really were unlikely. More importantly, immediately, the two governments created a whole range of working groups on issues of mutual interest. So far, what have these groups achieved? I'm just listing part of them. The revival of postal service between the United States and Cuba, suspended since the late 1960s when a bomb sent from the United States, a letter bomb, blew up and killed a postal employee in Havana. The resumption of regular airline service. The Delta frequent flyers in the audience, did you get that email about a month ago? Visit this amazing country, announcing Delta's daily service to Havana that began on December 1. I found that a particularly interesting moment when I opened up that email as a Delta flyer. And so there's now more than 100 weekly flights from a whole range of U.S. cities to several cities in Cuba. They will slowly replace the 10 charter flights a day that were going down just from Miami. Opportunities for U.S. business to operate in Cuba, including in the arena of telecommunications. But the main, this is we should be clear, the embargo remains fully in place under U.S. law. Under Torricelli, under Helms-Burton, the embargo is fully in place. And that does place very significant restrictions on what U.S. business can do. And also, the Cubans are being selective, partly because they are selective about what foreign direct investment they accept. They've been dealing with capitalist business folks from Europe and Latin America for the last 25 years. They're selective. It has to meet what Cuba considers part of its national development plan. They, for example, did reject, a little bit puzzling, a small U.S. tractor company that had been given permission by the U.S. government to potentially start manufacturing tractors at the Port of Mariel industrial zone in Havana, but the Cubans turned it down. They said they potentially would buy the tractors from their plant in Alabama if they were permitted to do so, but they weren't ready to put it on the island. And they did also reject efforts from U.S. telecommunications companies at this point to construct fiber optic cables throughout the island. A decision I was not fully aware of until I met one of my Mexican researcher friends in Mexico last week. There's an agreement between the countries on plans for oil spills in the Straits of Florida and for maritime safety in general. There's an agreement on medical trials for Cuban drugs to be done in the United States, with the potential then for the marketing of those drugs in the United States. There is cooperation in law enforcement, especially in the arena of counter-narcotics. By the way, that's a formal agreement now, but it's not new. The Cuban government has been cooperating with the United States on counter-narcotics trade at the insistence of the United States for quite a period of time. They were virtually told back a number of years ago, if you don't cooperate with us on this, this could be a major, we could escalate the nature of our pressure on you. The Cubans got the message, and so that's not a primary corridor of drugs making it to the United States. Tragically, in some ways, that's partly why Mexico is more in the crosshairs of that today. There was also an agreement on student exchanges. Cuban students coming and participating in programs sponsored by the U.S. government in the U.S., and U.S. students getting support from the U.S. government to study in Cuba. There are a number of outstanding issues. The one at the top of the list, as my good friend Duane Kroenke, who's in the audience, knows, is Guantanamo. The question of, for Cuba, the return of this piece of Cuban territory is highly important. But they didn't condition its return on the full diplomatic relations. They agreed to have the full diplomatic relations, but they wanted to talk about it. And this is a difficult issue because the United States has made clear, Jeffrey Lorenzis did it in front of a very non-friendly audience, if you will, of the Latin American Studies Association in New York, saying, no, Guantanamo is not on the table from the U.S. perspective. We know it's important to the Cubans, but he's just said, I have to be honest, from our perspective, it's not something we're ready to really engage in serious talk on. There are still very important obstacles to Cuba's full use of the U.S. dollar in international trading arena, in spite of commitments by the Obama administration that they would do, that they would take steps to convince U.S. banks and international banks to do so, but they've been contradictory because they've also continued to levy fines against banks that have been seen as violating the U.S. embargo. So that, for us, again, on the Cuban side, remains something they feel very strongly about. Radio and TV Marti continue broadcasting out of Florida, what the Cubans obviously would view would be anti-Cuban propaganda. Democracy promotion programs of on the island of working with political enemies of the Cuban government, people that they call dissidents. Those programs have continued. The Cuban Adjustment Act, the United States law that allows any Cuban who makes it to U.S. soil, up to their waist in water, to be eligible for political asylum in the United States. And from the Cuban perspective, you know, destabilizes normal migration between the two countries. I mean, there is normal migration. There's 20,000 plus visas a year that the two countries administer going back to 1994. But this kind of, from the Cuban perspective, of dangerous and illegal immigration happens because of this law, which gives Cubans a privilege that no other person in the world has. Now that the Cold War is over, you know, Eastern European people used to have those kind of provisions, but you know, that with the end of the Cold War, that went away. And then just finally, on the Cuban side, One of the, for them, a particularly galling program. The State Department still has in place a program where it seeks to convince Cuban medical doctors and personnel working abroad on Cuban medical missions, some of them humanitarian missions, to defect to the United States with offers of, you know, of basically being able to apply their doctoral skills in the United States. And that program has continued in spite of wonderful things that Susan Rice said this year at the UN about Cuba's work on Ebola and the like, and yet U.S. policy still has this program in place that seeks to get them to leave those programs and come to the United States. For the United States, there's outstanding issues. From the U.S., what's in the general frame of human rights is the lack of multi-party elections on the island. Cuba has an electoral system, a very formal one, that will eventually lead to the selection of a new Cuban president in 2018. But it's not multi-party. It's a system that is basically dominated by the Cuban Communist Party. And the arresting on a regular basis of Cubans for dissident political activity. It's illegal to have a counter-political party in Cuba, and those that seek to organize such or to politically object often do wind up facing jail time. Property claims. The United States considers that full, final resolution of what happened in 1959 needs to be done. The property of the people who lost their property due to the nationalizations of the revolution need to be adjudicated. Property claims were adjudicated with citizens of other countries, like Spain, who had property taken, but never been done with the United States because we've, you know, because of the nature of the relationship between the two. Should be said, Cuba acknowledges a need to address this because they under international law, the question of property claims is that, yes, you can have a revolution. You can decide that private businesses and private owners will no longer be a part of your social order. But you do owe them compensation. And so that's the basis of the conversation. What the Cubans counterclaim and makes it a difficult negotiation, maybe more so than otherwise, beyond the cost for Cuba, is that Cuba argues that the embargo, not so much the embargo, the United States has every right under international law to embargo another country. But Cuba would argue that it has always been a blockade, meaning it convinces under U.S. law companies and individuals in other countries not to trade. And that's against international law. And the Cubans argue, therefore, there's been damage from this blockade in the billions of dollars, which would, in their view, cancel the nature of these claims in terms of dollars. Also, there's the question of the return to the United States of fugitives from U.S. justice. People like the Black Panther, Assata Shakur, who went to Cuba, was convicted of the killing of a state trooper in New Jersey, has lived and worked in Cuba for many years. And there's a few other cases that the United States has pressed on. On that one, the Cubans have been very non-forthcoming, arguing that that's not something that they are prepared to yield on. Going forward, I'm just about finished here. Going forward, and I'll mainly want to deal with this in the question and answer. It now is a more interesting question, I think, than it would have been had Hillary Clinton been elected. If I were standing up here, as I knew I would be, before the U.S. election, I would have largely said, I think, pretty much stay the course. Everything that's going on would likely move forward, and I would have given the talk up till now identical, absolutely identical. But now we do have to ask, what will the incoming Trump administration do? We don't, the honest answer for any expert is we're not yet sure. I think some things about Trump, as Trump the Republican on U.S. domestic issues, is becoming very clear to folks about what he's going to do. That shouldn't surprise anyone. We elected a Republican to be president of the United States. But on foreign policy, as you probably know, it's much trickier. And Cuba's just one of the many issues on which it's harder to scope out exactly where he will take the administration. His initial statements on Cuba early in the campaign were more businessman Trump, who said, yes, we should be doing business with the island. It makes no sense to not do business when others do business there. But then the usual tagline, but it was important. I would have gotten a better deal. And what he did mean, and there was a certain truth to it, whether he definitively knew it or not, was that the United States did make most of the concessions to the Cubans because it was the U.S. that was changing its longstanding policy. It wasn't the Cubans that had per se sought out the opening. But once he sat down in a little Havana cafe with Marco Rubio at his side later in the campaign, he simply then sounded like every previous Republican candidate, of the mainstream Republicans at least, going back a long ways. He said all the things, the embargo is important, unless Cuba changes its political system and honors human rights, we shouldn't be doing business with this company. It's wrong. Businessmen that do that are being greedy. And then, since becoming president-elect, there have been more definitive statements. His key transition team person is a very conservative Cuban American who totally disagreed with the Obama overture and wants to reverse it, and he has basically said in some tweets that unless Cuba is more forthcoming on issues important to the United States, like political freedoms and human rights, he will cancel the deal. So in many ways, I think he's already, Trump the negotiator, is already signaling to the Cubans that it's not going to be the same, that there are going to be more definitive demands coming from whoever the U.S. negotiator is, and that Cuba will have to make some choices if it wishes certain things to go forward. But I will say this, I'm sure many in the audience have read pieces in the Wall Street Journal and other places. There are people within, very much deep within the Republican establishment, deep within the business establishment, who are going to push back because they've started already to make commitments and fly airplanes there and consult on hotels and get involved in telecommunications, and dialing that back is going to cost them money. And they took these things in good faith with U.S. government decisions, and they did not expect them to be reversed. Does it mean they won't be reversed? No. No, it doesn't mean they won't be reversed, but it means that within the Republican Party, I believe that there will be that pushback. And we're already getting, I know Craig Ostrom is here tonight, who works very hard on the Hill on these issues. And the people that are for continuing this, like Tom Emmer and Amy Klobuchar, they're already pushing back, trying to signal to the incoming administration that you need to keep this. This was something that was in the bipartisan national interests of the United States. But whether they'll succeed, that's harder to say. And as Craig and I have exchanged, the situation in Congress, which needs to step forward to end the embargo, unless Craig has new views in the last couple of weeks, we're not terribly optimistic. He's more the expert than I am. But it's a situation where we needed the Republican leadership to step forward. We needed Ryan and McConnell to step forward to support bipartisan efforts that are led by like folks like Jeff Flake in Arizona and Tom Emmer here in Minnesota. But in the absence of that, it's very hard in the ways of Washington to get bills of this import through, let alone if the president isn't willing to support them. So it's a very, moving forward on the congressional front, I think, is going to be very difficult with what happened in Congress, with the vote of the Republicans holding both houses, and now with a Republican in the White House. Well, I'll stop there and take your questions.
Gary, thank you. Great coverage of both the history and recent events. And just to pick up on your latest points, we know that Tom Emmer, Amy Klobuchar, both are very outspoken on the issue of changing our economic relationship with Cuba. In fact, Global Minnesota hosted an event with Senator
very much
Klobuchar.
Appreciated. I was there that day. There was a very, very, very good event. I appreciated that you did that, and we out of it formed Engage Cuba Minnesota, a local lobbying and political arm to continue to work for this to represent the interests of Minnesota as an agricultural state. And medical provider state.
Medical,
right?
and agriculture, exactly. So my question is, what's the role of the business community, corporate America, in pushing for their interests with regard to this change?
Those that are engaged want to do it, but this is the limitation, and I think Craig would agree with me. The long-time limitation is, this is only a market of 11 million. It is not a rich island in terms of disposable income. The people there live decently and, probably if you put in this whole social wage, live decently, but they don't have a lot of disposable income. So the opportunities are mainly the over 3 million tourists that they will receive. And so any U.S. company that wants to get into that is very much for it. Our ag interests, of course, are, because Cuba buys, especially even more, and they have more tourists, they have to buy more food because they're not able, for certain structural internal reasons, to grow enough food to meet both the population's needs and the 3 million tourists. And U.S. ag is in a great position, of course, to provide those sales. But those sales, when the embargo didn't end, those sales have been cut in half between, say, 10 years ago to now. Plus, I know that from conversations, a very nice meeting we had over at Humphrey years ago with the Cargill executive, talked about, we just don't want to sell to Cuba. We think there's investments we want to make in Cuban agriculture the way they do around the world to foster and grow production and the like. And again, they want clear end of the embargo to do those things, but they are only, I think, at the end of the day, a relatively small slice of the heart of U.S. business that is more able to get to Republicans across all states. I mean, our Republicans are generally receptive. The new man we don't yet know, Klein, as we used to joke, Klein had a thing about communism, and he never joined in. But the other Republicans, they pretty much represent their state and its ag interests. And we'll see. I know Craig has said we're going to be talking to Jason Lewis soon, and we hope that, he will be more in keeping with Minnesota interests. But I know I posed this question in a conference call with Susan Purcell from the University of Miami, explained that we had this bipartisan coalition in Minnesota. And she said, yeah, but you're Minnesota. You're an ag state. And so it's to be expected, and that alone isn't going to be enough to carry the business community's weight on this question.
So we do have questions open for the audience. While we're reaching those folks, can you talk a little bit about the role that Pope Francis and perhaps other intermediaries played in bringing these two sides closer together?
Yeah, I think the Pope did. I mean, though it was interesting, I think It's not to downplay the role of the Pope, but in many ways, I think the Canadians, or I think our friends to the north, were really the decisive ones, because, you see, Canada never broke diplomatic relations with Cuba. Only Mexico and Canada in the hemisphere didn't break diplomatic relations. They had their own reasons and interest in doing so, and Pierre Trudeau was quite close with the Fidel, for example, and they are their business interests. I mean, big. I know Robert Scarlett's here and has been involved with companies engaged in mining in particular, and a big company they have that doesn't do much business in the U.S., right? But has shared international, has been very engaged with their nickel mining, which is very important. So the Canadians, I think, were the main intermediaries. They were the ones that the United States, of course, can trust Canada as much as any country in the world. And the Cubans felt that of all the countries probably that they felt they had a good long-standing relationship and could trust was the Canadians. So they were the natural ones to be the intermediaries.
My perception about Fidel and Raul are fairly different. I mean, Fidel seemed like an ideologue, and Raul seemed a little less so. And of course, Fidel stepped down in 2006 and had health problems. I'm curious what the perception is in terms of what influence Fidel may have had after 2006, and how did he just acquiesce to Raul's reforms in 2011? Did he not care? What's the perception?
Well, I think he cared a lot. Because you get into the thing, we will never know what Fidel faced with the same economic challenges that Raul faced following the sets of hurricanes and the global economic meltdown that damaged tourism. We'll never know what Fidel would have been willing to do in terms of the economic reforms. I don't rule out that he would have. My perception of Fidel and the things I've written on Fidel are that he is more, his ultimate role was more pragmatic than many observers gave him credit for. And that to some degree, his role within the Communist Party, based on my long conversations with Cubans on the island, was often to be the one that was the ultimate arbitrator of different points of view. And he's the one that then, you know, would sort of bring it together and keep the unity of the party, which was always huge to him. And he went to his grave without there ever being a major split within that party, which in his mind, I think, was a great achievement. I think it was easier for Raul to do it, right? Whether Fidel would have done it's a moot point. It was easier for Raul because I do think most Cubans have felt, just because of the task he had leading the military, he had to be more pragmatic and task-oriented. And he, I think, studied in the Vietnam and China. Those were the two models. Especially Vietnam was seen as the model. More Vietnam than China. They sent their leading economists, like my friend Juan Triana. They were sent to Vietnam to look at how Vietnam had a privatized services sector and to see what that looked like and what you do and what you don't do. So I think yes, and I think at the end of the day, Fidel signed off on all the things that Raul has done, and I think he may have gone to his death, in one sense, with great satisfaction, that he lived to see the United States, through the 2014 opening, really, in some ways, fundamentally validating the legitimacy of the Cuban Revolution. Now, that's not true for everyone on the U.S. side of it, but I think that was the key thing for him.
Thank you, Gary. With respect to U.S. businesses today, we have Engaged Cuba, which is a coalition of U.S. businesses promoting engagement normalization with Cuba. We have Cargill leading the U.S. Agricultural Coalition for Cuba, which I think is very important. We have the Chamber of Commerce of the United States in favor of it, all business-related, presumably more influential with the Republican administration. And Tom Emery, you mentioned he's now chair of the House Cuba Working Group, and he recently wrote a letter to Trump supporting normalization. So I think we really need to support Tom Emmer in his efforts in this regard. I think we also, a lot of people miss, I think, two other arguments that should be important. The European Union just signed an agreement with Cuba. The United States, a lot of folks just think it's bilateral. But we have competition in the world, and if we don't get in there, other countries are going to do better than we could. I think also the collapse of Venezuela is important for Cuba going into a relationship with the United States. They were anticipating that. The United States does not want a failed state 90 miles away. And I also remember Raul Castro's report to the 7th Congress of the Communist Party earlier this year, where he said, as I read it, basically say, we really need private enterprise.
Yeah,
he doesn't use those words, but that's what he means. And he complains about the bureaucracy and the state-run enterprises, and they're being wedded to old ideas. So at least Raul knows that Cuba really needs more private enterprise on the island.
Completely agree with Duane, and I are good friends, have exchanged lots of conversations, and I'm totally in agreement with you. And on your earlier point, and when the thing, remember, about great decisions, when we do these great decision talks, we do them in part to have citizens think about an issue. You do not have to agree with Tom and I, with Duane and I, but when he says, if you are in agreement with us, act on it. Definitely send, you know, message to even directly to the Trump administration on this. You know, just act politically on this, because we are at a certain moment, and I truly believe that we don't definitively know yet exactly how the Trump administration will proceed. And Duane outlines very clearly the efforts, mainly from within the Republican Party and the business community, to try to keep this engagement going for all the reasons that Duane said, that American competitors are very definitely there and will continue to benefit more probably if the U.S. is not there.
Oh, hi. You were talking about the influx of flights that are going out to Cuba. I'm wondering, I've heard and seen some discussion about how tourism will positively affect the local community and some on how it will negatively affect the local community. What, with your experience, what would you say about that?
Yes, the question of the impact of the tourism. First of all, understand that they've been well up over 2 million visitors now for way more than a decade. The projection may be, and it's going to be over 3 million in 2016, maybe an additional half a million next year. There's limits, however, to how many more tourists can take, and there will be, therefore, I'm sure that the Cubans will keep to some degree limits on the number of flights that come in, for example, because there still needs to be more hotels or restaurants and other facilities. There was an interesting article in the New York Times that does raise a challenging issue for Cuba on this front, and that is the competition for foodstuffs. Especially important vegetables for the Cuban diet that are grown on the island and not imported, and the competition for who gets them between the Cuban private markets, which have been in place for many years. That's not a new private initiative, where Cubans have to go. But the prices are going up because you've got people coming in from the restaurants, the private restaurants, buying things up. The prices go up. The Cuban government's trying to intervene in that. But, of course, it's always a little hard once you start to open a private sector and private market. You have to be very careful about how you manage it, and you can't discourage the private producers from getting a better price. So I think that's there. Cuba's, the larger influx of U.S. tourists, I don't see that definitively changing Cuba, and as I said, because you have to appreciate that they've been getting millions of tourists over the last 20 years from around the world. Those tourists are not necessarily different from U.S. tourists. U.S. tourists are not necessarily different from them. They go to Cuba for a whole number of reasons, some for beaches, some for a more cultural experience. But the reality is that there are challenges. Cubans have always said it. Tourism is not the best way to run a country's economy. That's why they've bet a lot on biomedical technology, for example, as an important way of going forward, of continuing to develop their nickel production. So those things are, and to continue to look for oil in the Gulf of Mexico.
Yeah, my question is about medical technology. You know, Cuba's long had pretty good health care compared to most of the world. They've exported a lot of doctors, but they do seem to have shortages of certain medical equipment and supplies, and I'm wondering, I'm not really up to date on where they are in comparison to, say, European or Western medical technology at this point.
In terms of technology, at the top end of the system, it's very high. I'm not an complete expert in that arena, but they do transplants. This is at the top end of a system that begins very much at the clinic level, but eventually pushes people up through a referral system to the national hospital system. One of the things that frustrates the Cubans and that I've never been able to get completely a full understanding of has been a shortage of certain kinds of drugs on the island, that they sort of ration. In other words, that you get a headache, you can't just necessarily go down to the corner grocery store and buy an Advil. You know, that it isn't the way it works in Cuba. Almost all drugs are rationed through the clinic system. And so, sure, that can frustrate Cubans when maybe they just need a fairly simple medicine, but they can't get it. Main thing for Cuba, in a sense, is the health, ultimate health outcomes with, far, far less resources spent on it than in the United States. The life expectancy is basically identical to the United States, and the infant mortality rate is slightly lower or at par with the United States. And it's based on this system of community-based medicine, and I know that that's what U.S. professionals are now starting that are going down to Cuba are studying. You know, how do you do this? How do you deliver at the end of the day these health outcomes with so much fewer resources than we expend in the U.S.?
I have a follow-up on the tourism question. Given everything that the new administration is going to have coming in on their plate, do you see them changing the Cuba policy, travel?
The travel policy, that one I think is probably fairly secure. In other words, partly because the major U.S. airlines have committed to this and have, there's an airline agreement in place between the two countries, and so I don't see the travel one being reversed. And please understand that what they did when they put in regular airline flights, they also made it basically very easy for U.S. citizens to legally travel to the island, even though there's still a formal travel ban. You just have to, if you try to book a flight, I don't know if anyone has done it, if you book a flight to Havana or any other place in Cuba, a screen comes up in which you have to verify that you fall under one of the 12 categories of travel. But it's self-policing. You do that, and then you proceed on to purchase your ticket. So I've been telling people, for all intents and purposes for U.S. citizens, that travel ban has ended. Now, could the Trump administration suddenly say, wait a second, that screen that the major airlines have put up there, that's not enough, that you're really, the U.S. airlines are really subverting U.S. law here? I don't rule it out. He could do so. It's within the power of the president to do so. But on that one, I don't see as likelihood. And I don't know where we stand definitively, Craig, but I know there's still maybe some greater possibility for movement on travel in Congress than there is on ending the full embargo.
Thank
So, no, I wouldn't say that you should, if you're planning to visit Cuba, that you need to rush to get your ticket in a in this normal way because it's going to be closed off. I don't see.
I have a question. I was able to visit Cuba a week before President Obama did, just taking a chance through Mexico and getting there. And one of the things that struck me is that the value of the American dollar, first of all, we didn't bring enough, and it wasn't worth that much. And it wasn't until we were running on fumes on our budget towards the end of our stay that we figured out there's kind of a lower tier economy that the nationals use. And that saved us. So I was wondering, one question, how will that rectify? We were spending, big bucks initially, and they were running down, and then finally, when we got into the national economy, we could survive for the last couple of days.
Well, you were very innovative to get into the national economy, because it's not easy to do that, because it's not against the law, but most Cubans that sell services, if they see that you are a foreigner, will demand that you pay for the services, food or whatever, in the convertible currency. And of course, part of the thing where you said you didn't bring enough money, yeah, if anyone thinks that Cuba is a bargain destination, that you can go there like you can to Mexico or other places where the US dollar is weak, no. Because in that sense, the U.S. dollar is weak in the sense of the one-to-one, and so you're going to generally pay a good price for most any hotel, and even, you have to almost stay in private homes in the neighborhood of, and then that's fully within the system, and you pay in Cuban foreign currency, if you will, the CUC, for maybe $25 or $30 a night. Versus a hotel that's going to probably be at least 100, but the economy. They've talked for a number of years of bringing the two economies together, but it's a marker of Cuba's economic difficulty that the level of productivity on the island has not reached the point where they really could bring the two economies together and have prices that Cuban citizens could then afford for their basic necessities. That's for the moment and probably for the foreseeable future why there are those two economies. And it is, yes, the fact that things are quote unquote relatively cheap for Cubans is what sustains the Cuban system for Cubans. But charging tourists more is also what sustains the system, because that's one of their key hard currency earning things. What they have done is, it is generally a bit cheaper than the United States, than Florida. And so more than 1 million Canadians a year fly over Florida on the way to their vacations in Cuba. And that is a key part, almost a third, of Cuba's tourism. But it is because it's a bit cheaper there and safe. It has the advantage that Cuba, Havana is probably the safest large city in the world for a tourist and even for a resident. So it has attractions of safety and price for tourists. And we'll see how U.S. tour. Now there will be more of how people like yourself will and others that follow you will see it.
I have a question for you.
Oh. No, go ahead.
Okay. Regarding the role of the U.S. Embassy in Cuba, I know you said there's no formal ambassador, but I had been there this past spring and been a victim of a robbery, which I know is rare, but the embassy was unable to intercede in my behalf with the police or anything like that. I'm curious as to if they're able to do that with the increase in American citizens.
That'll be interesting. Traditionally, I had a situation where also we did have something was stolen from a colleague on a trip, and the U.S. Embassy was very helpful, got us, we were able to get through the embassy, the money wired down to replace what she needed for our program, but she needed to go directly and work with the Cuban police on the question of the robbery. And I think that's fairly standard around the world. In other words, the U.S. Embassy will help with certain things, but they're not likely to intercede in most countries with the local police. And I don't think that's necessarily definite, you know, relates specifically to Cuba. Now, it's possible that, again, with very much better relations, maybe the embassy would, you know, might have been in a position to offer a little more advice or something like that. But generally, I think that's fairly pro forma around the world.
Gary, we're so privileged to have you here right at this time. And while we're still sort of sorting out and thinking through the legacy left by Fidel Castro, I want to have you roll back to, I think it was 2010 September, the article that appeared in Atlantic, where he was asked about the future of the Cuban system and whether it was working. And he said something to the effect that, well, it's not working for us
anymore. Yeah, the ironic question was the Cuban model still valuable in the wider world? And he said, well, it isn't really completely working for us either. I think that was a preface, Rob, of the decision by the Party Congress the following year that they were going to go a different direction. Now, people might have thought that meant more than it did, you see. And we then got the details a year later. What, at least for the moment, what that meant was a totally nationalized economy, including the service sector, isn't working. And so that's, I think, it shouldn't be taken too much more than that was a preview of that fairly dramatic move to say that a million Cubans, rather than just at that time about 200,000, would work outside of government employment. Now, whether at some point, you know, they go further, that's another question. I haven't seen any indication that from, say, the more recent party Congress that they're ready to do that. They're still implementing that because they're still only up to maybe 500,000, 600,000. They're still short 5 years on. They haven't moved as many people into private employment and out of government employment as had been the original plan, because there is, you know, there's resistance from within Cuban authorities, state managers and the like, and there's resistance to some degree from Cubans. I mean, you go into the private sector now, and you know what you have to do for the first time in your life? Pay income tax. They've always paid, so they have Social Security tax, small, you know, piece that supports the retirement, but they never paid income tax. And now it's people that are in this new, they have to pay income tax. I know a friend who has a private room that they rent, and they have to keep records, and they basically have a tax collector comes around at this point every month. It goes over the books, and the books have to be justified with the passport and the person they can connect with when they entered the country, and now they're staying with them rather than in a hotel, and they state how much they have paid, and they owe, based on that amount of money they've collected, they owe a tax. So that part, to some Cubans, that's not worth it. To some Cubans, that's not worth it. That, rightly or wrongly, that's the, you know, system they've lived under, and they aren't necessarily want to be taking the risk. They prefer a secure government job and not having to worry about lots of other things like taxes and the like.
Well, Gary, unfortunately, we have run out of time, and I know there are a lot of questions we didn't get to, so I hope if you're able to stick around afterwards, some people would probably love to
sure
get your thoughts on something, some of their questions that we didn't get to. But please join me in thanking Gary for sharing these wonderful insights.
Thank you for your questions.